This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thank you so much for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we're going to take a look at our image-driven world. Our guest is Kiku Adato. She writes about culture, politics, and the media. She's the author of Picture Perfect, Life in the Age of the Photo Op. Adato says our photo op culture has been unfolding since the Second World War. Where are we today? Well, think about it for a moment. We're surrounded by cameras. How many of us have cell phone cameras? We have webcams. How many people watch YouTube, contribute to it? And then there are surveillance cameras watching us as we move about the world, as we move about our communities. We love pictures. And Kiku Adato says, in her words, we have even developed an affection for artifice and an appreciation of slick production values, whether in political campaigns, Super Bowl commercials, celebrity photographs, or a favorite movie. At the same time, she says, we want authenticity. Kiku Adato is a scholar in residence at Harvard University's Humanities Center. Her writings on culture, politics, and the media have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and the New Republic. Picture Perfect, Life in the Age of the Photo Op is published by the Princeton University Press. Kiku Adato, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
The last few weeks have offered us a dazzling array of media events and photo ops. Beijing, Denver, St. Paul. Have you been watching?
Of course. And it has been arranged from the manipulative pictures of the little girl singing where there was another little girl's voice that was actually the person singing, to the spectacular visual display of the Beijing Olympics, to the current Republican convention where we have John McCain and his running mate, Sarah, trying to portray themselves as mavericks.
Yeah. Also, I think something that has occurred to me over watching, you know, bits and pieces of all of these events has been the starring role for women and children.
Yes, that's true, and it's been a starring role fraught with ambivalence. First, Hillary Clinton drew a huge amount of supporters when she was running for president, and yet her candidacy was fraught with conflict and dispute in the sense of the role of women in politics. Was she being too tough? In the turning point with Bill Clinton in South Carolina, were they turning to a more negative, a dirty campaign, raising the question of race? What was her relationship with Bill Clinton? How autonomous was she? And then with Sarah Palin, we have a whole new set of issues as she casts herself as the outsider, maverick, Western governor who is qualified to be the vice president of the United States.
Mm. And also in Sarah Palin and in Michelle Obama, we have mothers. We have very skilled communicators. And their children have taken a role in these conventions.
What's interesting, going back to Sarah Palin, who we just saw giving her acceptance speech, is the way she's reconciling in the role of the maverick different aspects of women's roles. She's incorporating the maverick identity with the traditional values of the Christian right, evangelical Christians, and she's portraying herself as both a devoted mother and a mother who would have a child with Down syndrome and would not consider an abortion, at the same time being a very independent and strong woman, beholding to no one, not the special interests, not even her own Republican Party in Alaska. So what's interesting about her is, less qualified than Hillary Clinton, she nevertheless is tapping into some stronger cultural myths in America, the same ones that John McCain is.
Yeah. I've seen just so far today, I haven't had time, but I've seen one review from a television critic about her speech last night, Tom Shales of the Washington Post. He says, quote, she proved herself in the great arena. That's what counts politically. Nobody could watch that speech and still consider her a joke, no matter how flimsy her credentials and qualifications may seem on paper. The joke, it seems, is on those who had been laughing at her. Last night, the laughing ended and the cheering began. And it's interesting that we have a television reviewer here. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, I think that we have a captive audience in terms of the constituency and the delegates at the Republican National Convention. So she, as long as she could give a good speech and she's well-practiced in that, she would go over in a huge way. The question remains, what is going to be the cultural aftershock and the political aftershock and aftermath? Is she going to be able to sustain herself as a candidate substantively with the command of both international issues and domestic issues? Yeah. Is she going to be able to answer the questions once she's released from the obviously, in terms of both parties, very managed in terms of stagecraft events of the conventions. Mm.
What's your assessment of the news media coverage of this year's conventions and campaigns?
Well, one of the problematic aspects of the coverage is the cable news networks, CNN and MSNBC, which has become really characterized by opinion-laden journalism, where people like Wolf Blitzer are making pronouncements about how exciting or dramatic, or in the case of Sarah Palin saying how courageous her candidacy is. Use the words bold and courageous. Bold, you could see, fits in with journalistic values because bold can go many ways. But when journalists begin to offer their opinions, it shades into a different kind of journalism, the op-ed kind. And it's interesting that the talking heads and pundits of the networks are veering more into stronger opinion journalism on both Fox, MSNBC, and CNN.
Yeah. When did that begin to happen? Maybe we can go back in time 20 years, 40 years, 1968, 1988.
Right. My book goes back to the 68 presidential race between Humphrey, Nixon, and Wallace, and shows that even though that was the year we remember from the book, The Selling of the President, during that period, network evening news coverage still was very, very straight documentary style. There was a complete split between opinions and news coverage. The average soundbite for a candidate or anyone on the political news coverage of that campaign was 42.3 seconds. They didn't show ads. They didn't show gaffes and failed images. When Agnew, Nixon's running mate, made a slip of the tongue and called Hubert Humphrey who called Nixon a Neville Chamberlain when he meant to say Hubert Humphrey, the networks played it straight. They made no big hoo-ha about it. By 1988, when George Herbert Walker Bush made a slip of the tongue and gave the wrong date for Pearl Harbor Day. He said September 7th instead of December 7th. It led, the anchors led that with every news broadcast, with Dan Rather saying a strange happening occurred in Louisville. So there was this huge shift in the blowing up of what we now call gotcha moments. Mm-hmm. And the showing ads on television. We remember from the 88 campaign, the Willie Horton ad was shown on a cable news station and then picked up by the major networks and showed repeatedly on the broadcasts. So words shrank, images grew, opinion journalism grew, and ads became a huge part of television news coverage. Mm.
Where are we this year in terms of the crop of political ads and how news coverage has handled them?
I think that there have been advances since certainly 20 years ago. 20 years ago in the 1988 campaign, that networks ran the ads without doing fact correction for the most part. And sometimes they would just run them as wallpaper for their stories, background images. But in 1992, the newspapers, local television, and finally the networks did run ad fact checking. So that's a standard part of political coverage and an important part. But what's interesting about the ads in this campaign, going back to McCain, is the coherence of his ads in terms of the theme of the maverick, the insider-outsider. He casts himself, though having been a multi-term senator, as a outsider to Washington. One of the ads begins, "Washington's broken. John McCain's going to fix it." And it portrays him in the same mode as we would see a Western hero or Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry, a maverick who works within the institution and yet fights it, bucks bureaucracy, fights the special interest. And so this has been a very cohesive, mythic dimension of John McCain's. The slip was appropriate because he's casting himself as a John Wayne, heroic type of soldier and maverick.
Yeah, it's interesting. And maybe you would talk with us about an Obama ad.
Obama's ads are not as mythic. They don't tap into these core American stories. Let me say, however, before talking more about his ads, his speech at the convention and the general core of the things he says does tap into another important American story, and that is very much tied up with the idea of America's mission, the democratic we-ness that was part of Roosevelt's great rhetoric and his fireside chats, the idea of connecting Americans to a sense of common purpose and a sense of a mission and a sense of a set of values that holds us together about upholding democracy and liberty and leading the way for reform. So that is Obama's speeches, which have electrified the country, that are deeply embedded in core American values. His ads tend to try to debunk McCain as a true Washington outsider, link him to George Bush, and link him to the problems that we've had in the last 8 years in Washington, both domestically and in terms of the Iraq War. So the Democrats want Bush and McCain to stick together. McCain, on the other hand, actually has in his ad that we are not better off than we were 4 years ago, without mentioning Bush. So he wants to distance himself as much as possible from Bush in order to succeed in his presidential bid.
Hmm. You mentioned a moment or two ago gotcha moments.
Yes.
And photo ops and media events offer players, political or otherwise, a way to package themselves, to present themselves. But sometimes they backfire. And so they provide great material for comics and satirists. Are we maybe a little too fond of the gotcha moment? Are there consequences to this material that is out there that we have an affection for?
In one way, the gotcha moments are very problematic. When the gotcha moment is about a squealing microphone or choking on food or singing the Star Spangled Banner off key, that's problematic because it elevates something quite trivial in the event and makes it the lead story. So those are problematic. On the other hand, the focusing on gotcha moments that are often a product of actual documentation of a real problem or real event are helpful to our body politic. Let me give you the example of the Makaka incident, when George Allen, who was at one point considered a contender for president, called the aide to the other side, the Democratic Party candidate who was taking videos, Makaka, and pointed to him. Now, the fact that that was recorded on video and then put on YouTube allowed people to see and air to the light of day this kind of racial slur. So it really cuts both ways. What we have to focus on is the content of what the gotcha is about. So when we say gotcha, generally, we mean something trivial. On the other hand, exposing flaws, the fact that, as you said at the beginning, the camera is everywhere. And as a Republican operative said, the days of the network news being the dominant way of recording things is over, because politicians used to shoot from the hip when the cameras weren't around. But now the cameras are everywhere, cell phone cameras, digital cameras, tape recorders. So politicians have to be consistent, and I think that that's good for our democracy.
You mention Abraham Lincoln in this book. He was pretty savvy about the power of pictures. So, too, Pope John Paul II. You want to tell us these stories?
Sure. We often think of Abraham Lincoln as a man that would never make it in the age of the photo op. But actually, he was very savvy about photographs. and thanked Matthew Brady, the famous photographer who took his daguerreotype, the word that we use for the old-fashioned photographs, for helping him win the White House. And one of his advisors said that images broadcast are an excellent means of electioneering. So when Lincoln they had the convention for Lincoln, the huge portrait of him was brought out on stage, and photographs, copies of photographs, were fluttered down like confetti. So that's Lincoln. And so we know that from the very beginning of the photograph, as soon as it was available, politicians used it as a form of image making. As far as Pope John Paul II, one of the points I make in the book is, getting back to this affection for artifice, one part of it is that people now think that posing is a dirty word. If you say, oh, this picture was posed, a politician posed for it, or someone posed for it, then that discredits the photograph. Photographs, very famous ones, have been discredited unfairly, like the flag waving on Iwo Jima. It circulated for a long time that that was a posed picture, which it was not. So what I try to do in the book is show examples of when posing is in the service of something deeply authentic. In the case of John Paul II, here's a pope who was very savvy about television, and when a local priest came and wanted to have the local news people take some footage of the pope and him, he wryly commented, if you don't see it on television, it doesn't really happen. And the Vatican has very modern means of communication, internet, all kinds of understanding of even the most deeply conservative message of John Paul in terms of celibacy, in terms of birth control, could be conveyed through this modern medium. Another powerful example of posing not in authenticating a photograph is in 1963 when a Buddhist monk burned himself protesting the South Vietnamese government's policies. The night before, his order put out a press release so that AP would be there to take that picture. Because if there was no camera there, the protest would not have had an international public looking at it. Mm. And so it's not the pose, but what the pose is about.
Yeah.
A photo op is artifice if what you're doing is really faking it in the picture.
Yeah.
Then it should be exposed.
Very interesting. Maybe in a little while we can talk about another photograph that you talk about in the book, at the end of the book, the photograph of Tomoko being bathed.
Yes.
We can talk about that. That's a very interesting photograph as well. And I think it's something that people will recall, will remember having seen. But in the meantime, we're going to take a call from a listener. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Kiku Adato. She writes about culture, politics, and the media. She's the author of Picture Perfect, Life in the Age of the Photo Op. Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon with a phone call. We look forward to your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Now let's go and talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
You've got to mention something about that horrible photo op taken of George Herbert Walker Bush when he threw up in the lap of the Japanese ambassador. That, to me, was the low point in photojournalism. I didn't vote for the man, but I just thought that was beyond the pale.
No, I think that's a great point. It's just that kind of thing that I was referring to. It's what it does is it has no respect for the dignity of the politician, nor does it have any respect for the private public distinction, that there are certain things that shouldn't be before the public view.
How do the news media deal with those kinds of gaffes? And photo ops that go awry, how do they make their choices?
Well, there's an interesting example of that where we the public, got a look at their reasoning. When Bush went to Beijing in an earlier visit, before the last visit to the Olympics, to meet with the president of China, there was a photo op that he had many photo ops that were of, you know, dignitaries and meeting with leaders. But afterwards, there was a press conference, and what the New York Times did was take a picture that made George Bush look incredibly goofy. He had trouble exiting from the stage. There was a big red door with big gold knobs, and you see his handle, his hand on the handle of the door with a very goofy Alfred E. Newman kind of look on his face. And they ran a sequence of these pictures, one approaching the door, then the goofy look, then a signal from the aide to go to the other door and Bush waving goodbye, on the front page of the New York Times like a huge political cartoon. And it was clearly making the president look ridiculous. And the rationale that they gave when people wrote into the public editor and it was published and he talked to the public editor, talked to the different editors at the Times, was they had given Bush his stage photo ops many times, victory in Iraq, other ennobling images. And why couldn't they have their day showing this picture? And what I point out is that it's really a battle for the control of the photo op, but it shouldn't be waged on those terms in which the press makes a politician look ridiculous or shows them, as your earlier caller said, in a, an embarrassing moment that shouldn't be there, you know, shouldn't be seen by public by the public at all, and concentrate instead on looking whether or not the picture that the politician is contriving is newsworthy, because it always takes two to tango with a photo op. The politician sets up the picture, but the press has to take the dance card. They have to take the picture. And it's at that point that the news values come in. Is this a picture worth taking, or is there some other news event or some other way to convey the content of what the politician is saying besides the contrived photo op?
Hmm. I'm thinking right at this moment of Gerald Ford and what happened to him. He was, you know, lampooned so many times as being, you know, graceless in, you know, falling and that kind of thing. It's that also, what happened there?
Well, it's the beginning. As I said, 68, yeah. It's completely absent from the coverage. By Gerald Ford in 72, it's the first hints of this change by making him look ridiculous as a stumbler when he was a star athlete and football player and an incredibly coordinated person. And Chevy Chase also made that the butt of his jokes on Saturday Night Live. That's the first inkling, but it hadn't become a dominant form of coverage. But you're right, that's the moment when it really starts. And as I said, it's not a good tendency. It's not the way to break through the photo op or for the press to break through to the truth or reality or give the public a fuller picture of what's up. I've thought about that tendency, and I'm wondering if it was partly connected in some subterranean way with Ford's connection with Nixon and the pardon of Nixon, that it was some way to make him look ridiculous. Of course, we could never know. But that tactic of taking the small stumble and making it big news is very problematic, as I said, because it goes beyond politics now. It goes, of course, to celebrity photographs where there are a whole bunch of paparazzi trying to find the cellulite and the food dripping from their mouths and the hair messy. But it also goes to Facebook and YouTube, where people are doing it to each other. With the means of taking these pictures, you can take a friend or a colleague in an off moment at a party and make and then post that picture up, and pretty soon it's flying around the internet. So the fact that this mentality, the battle over photo ops and the featuring of failed photo ops and gotcha moments has permeated our everyday life is a deeply troubling question about human dignity, about the fate of the photograph, about the respect we have for each other.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon. Line one, hold on. We've got you now. There you are. Hello.
I've been watching hours of TV in the last 2 weeks, and two visual images that I think will remain with me forever. Item number one was Obama's youngest daughter saying how much she loved him. And the second one, and I'm wondering if this was actually staged, was that delightful picture of Palin's youngest daughter licking her hand and smoothing her brother's hair.
Yeah, I saw that too last night. Let's hope those were genuine moments. Kiku Adado, what do you think?
I think that those are two interesting choices because, it gets to one of the core elements of political image making, and that is the aspect of family and family values. And they really are two separate things in the sense of how you're portraying your family and how much it draws us in to humanizing the politician when we see the spontaneous moments, especially with the children, and those are two great examples, so that it makes them less distant figures. And there's something about Americans and the way we choose candidates, especially at the presidential level, that we need them to be both close to us and yet at the same time distant in the sense that they are extraordinary, as each, both Obama and McCain portray themselves as strong leaders who can be definitive and lead the country in its fight against terrorism, in international relations, in the hard domestic questions that we are facing with the economy. So it's that combining of close and homey and at the same time extraordinary. And we have that. It's distinct to the democratic culture of this country that we have that commingling as well as the idea of the maverick, the insider-outsider, because before when I was mentioning McCain, Obama also presents himself not as a maverick in the sense of the war hero or bucking the system, but the insider-outsider in terms of the reformer. The Mr. Smith goes to Washington. The idea of somebody coming and trying deep to reform the system and bring back the democratic values and bring back a renewed economy.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Not with that, but with something I think that's related, and that is that as I was listening to Palin, I felt that if I had been not paying attention to the content but paying only attention to her style, I wouldn't have known if I was listening to her or to Susie Orman. I felt as if the style was almost identical to one that's very much used by women presenters. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. You care to comment?
I would be curious to know what more about the style that so intrigued the caller, but I think that it's this combination for women of self-possession, which was also such a big part of Hillary Clinton's appeal, that she was knowledgeable, that she was self-possessed, that she was the answer lady, that she was articulate. And that is an important component of key women political figures.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line 2. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. This whole image thing is very interesting, and you're onto something here. It's sort of in a latter-day analysis. I have a PhD in art history, so I'm very image conscious.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
And we go back to Lescaut 50,000 years ago, and you have all these images, not of people, but of animals and how they were thought of. There's huge arguments in the anthropology field about what they meant. But then if you go further up, you go to Rome, and you go to the Assyrians, and you see how they have these grand palaces. And I think the word spectacle is more appropriate here. But it's interesting how we're so image conscious, but yet in modern terms, it's more language is attached to the image. How you think about it or discuss it is as important as the image itself. Would you comment on that?
First of all, those are all really great points, that the idea of images being so potent as a means of conveying the forms of ruling or command in a leader go back, to the ancient world, whether it was the spectacle and pomp and circumstance of the ancient great empires or their drawings right up to the modern time. So we are seeing a modern spectacle. The second point about words and images is vital, that and it's something I talk a lot about in the book, the interplay of words and images, because we're an image-obsessed culture, but on the other hand, pictures don't make sense without words, without a context, without a story to go with them. They really are incomplete. And so we need the words with the images. And one of the examples I give at the very beginning of the book is Bush's mission accomplished landing on the aircraft carrier, which at the time in 2003 was lauded and praised as the greatest photo op of all time. And he had this huge event. The networks compared him to great heroes of the movies and Top Gun and Air Force One and Independence Day. But what undid that picture was not the image itself, but the fact that the Bush team had planted a sign in the background, mission accomplished. And those two words were a declarative statement that as soon as the war unraveled, and it wasn't true that the mission had been accomplished, then reality, in a sense, unfolding reality, undid the picture. But it was the words that were so key. The same with the cell phone video of the Saddam execution. What troubled people about the video was we heard words for the first time. We heard how chaotic it was. We heard the traded insults from the Shia, you know, and the traded insults between Saddam and the Shia who were taking him to his death, to the gallows. Whereas in the state-run picture, it was silent with the state providing the narrative. Or when we first saw the state-run video, the official one, it were our people running the narrative. So that interplay is amazingly important and always a fundamental part of image making. That's why the image makers are now trying to plant words in the picture. That's an innovation that began in about 1992. Caption your picture. It backfired with Bush, but they're doing it a lot these days.
Well, I would actually agree with that. Also, go back and look at Jasper Johns' paintings. I don't know if you know his works or not.
Yes.
How he you know, played with image and word, word is image, word together, and, you know, collages, oils. And there's a lot of really good art historical analysis of that because it was done in the late 50s, early 60s. And sort of a precursor to this maybe is almost like an artistic prod to maybe marketing people that would look at this, because I also have spent 10 years in marketing, so I know how to, I know the lie, and or not to make a lie, a good lie. I consider advertising the great lie, I call it the acceptable lie versus, you know, the lie from a politician. You know, out of his mouth comes the words of, you know, the devil or whatever the terms you want to use, depends on who who's listening. But your stuff is really interesting, but I would say somebody in the audience would maybe want to look at Johns' work because it's old enough, and it first looks a little banal, but then if you see what he was looking at and how he was thinking about it, something very key to your thesis, too. And thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Bye.
Also, I like your point very much about the Jasper Johns, and to extend it, Andy Warhol, and a whole part of the book talks about the role of artists and art photographers awakening the public to these new uses of the media and how they use the media in their art and in their photography, and called into question many, many aspects of our consumer society, and also the earliest people to call into question the photo op culture and to show images of images, or to show the photographer's hand in the frame. Art photographer Lee Friedlander took a series of photographs of, and in every photograph, his shadow or his camera is in the frame, showing that the photographer is a performer in the picture, making us aware that there is an interpretation involved in every photograph, that all photographs are contingent.
So I'll keep this on the short side, but we have, within these conventions, these spectacles, as the caller mentioned, we have images within images within images. You know, the stagecraft, the candidates, families, giant video screens, and there's words and images. There's so much going on there. That's my comment, and I guess we can go on next, unless you want to follow up on that, and then we can take some more calls.
Let's take some more calls.
Okay.
Your listeners are absolutely great.
Okay. Next, we go to a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'm concerned about the invasion of people's privacy with the photography. I'm wondering if there's any kind of process going on to limit the closeness they can get to people, like, let's say, Britney Spears when she's in the car trying to drive with her children. and it makes it dangerous, puts her in a dangerous position.
I don't know all of the latest legal battles in terms of the distancing. I know that different towns and certainly in Hollywood have tried to develop ordinances or laws that talk about keeping a certain distance. But we have a homey example we're all familiar with, and that is the relatively recent phenomenon of banning cell phones in gyms and in locker rooms. Why? Because we can take pictures. And so that this idea of off-limits for photographs is an important thing to do in certain realms, just like in some enlightened schools, they don't even let kids have cell phones at all because not only can they take pictures or even cheat with pictures, they don't even want them talking on the cell phones. So I think just as we used to say, one of the ways to get kids not watching bad television shows or just becoming couch potatoes is simply to turn off the TV or limit the TV. The same thing with this encroachment of the camera. There are certain arenas of life, certain zones we should think of or try to think of as camera-free.
Does the caller want a quick follow-up?
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, like taking pictures through Madonna's window in her bedroom. Distance, I think, would be a good thing in certain areas. And especially when you put people at risk, like Diana, probably one of the reasons she was killed was because the paparazzi was following her car.
Thanks for the call.
I think those are good points. And the troubling thing, the danger of our photo op age and the omnipresence of picture-taking devices is that we are drawn in to being paparazzi, that anyone with a cell phone camera or a digital camera can become a member of the paparazzi these days. And so what happens with the movie stars or celebrities, what happens with the politicians is something that's also going to happen to us. And that's why it's a very reflective question on the part of the caller to look at this in terms of public and private life and in terms, as I said earlier, about respect and dignity for the individual, because that's really the deeper value that's at stake in the age of the photo op, is losing that sense of respect and dignity.
Yeah. That's also an issue in reality television, too, isn't it?
Yes, because one of the interesting things about our time, and it began with the early talk shows, Donahue, Oprah, and now what extended in reality television, is another version of framing the flaw that the way that you get notoriety, the way that you get attention in memoirs or on reality television is by spilling your guts and exposing your private life to public view. And that is, I think, is another deep problem, a really spiritual problem, a problem for the soul in this culture, because as the self becomes magnified and then defined by exposure and shamelessness, then the soul as a source of rootedness and the self in terms of seeing a human being as special and worthy of respect recedes because we think anything goes.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I've been interested in the massive repression of photo ops in Minneapolis. Apparently there were like hundreds of people arrested for demonstrating mothers and children and stuff, and media people having their cameras smashed, which I guess is illegal, and video cards taken, so we didn't even hear the story, and we certainly didn't see the images.
That's interesting. I don't know the details on Minneapolis, but you make an important point, which is every time a picture is taken, we only see what's in the frame. We only see a narrow part of the universe of what's in the frame. And one of the examples I give in the book, it's a long ways from Minneapolis, but it was the toppling of the Saddam Hussein statue in Iraq. And when we saw it on television and in the newspapers at the time, in 2003, it was a pretty close shot, and we saw this statue toppling, and it felt like the Berlin Wall was falling. But if the cameras had pulled back and I looked at the original footage from one of the networks and shown us the wider angle, there were few people in the square celebrating, and the statue was toppled by the U.S. military with U.S. military equipment. That would have given us a very different picture of the significance of that event.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago. Line 4. Hi.
Thank you. Your comments and insights reminded me of the observations of Marshall McLuhan some time ago when he especially points at the medium as a message and how we're seeing the effects and consequences of the technology that we have today. I was wondering briefly if you had any thoughts of the influence here Marshall McLuhan had into broadening our observations.
Well, I think you're right. He certainly awakened people to the important media of his day and of our day. But one of the things that I talk a lot about in the book and reflect upon is how much it isn't simply technological innovation that shapes these changes, but predispositions. And this is a wild thought, but in some ways, the photo op culture that we see today is something that begins in terms of a certain form of self-consciousness about images and how you're perceived. All the way, we can trace it all the way back to the Renaissance, where we look at the plays of Shakespeare and there are all the asides and stepping back, and a big theme in Shakespeare is the difference between seeing and being. What you see, for example, in Hamlet is not the truth. The king has actually murdered Hamlet's father. The queen has married him. They're all forms of duplicity at court. And Hamlet is trying to find the truth, to find beneath the layers of all of the image making, of all of the pageantry, of all of the artifice, of all of the fakery, what's true, and act on it to in a just way to redress those grievances. So I could always imagine an interesting version of Hamlet with cell phones and video cameras and all this digital, because it goes with the mentality. Now, they didn't have the means, obviously, in the days of Shakespeare. The camera, the photograph, is not invented until 1839. And by then, the sensibility of that era, as aware as they were of artifice, and they were, right from the beginning that the camera could lie, it's our times that have this acute sense of the manipulation that the camera can partake in, and yet, as I say, an infatuation with that process of image making, and we forget sometimes as savvy people and as cynics that images mean things. And that what we should focus on is the content of the image and not the medium or the way it's made. But what is that image about? What is it saying? And is it true?
Hmm. We have just a little time left here, but let's squeeze in our last caller, a listener on a cell phone, line 2. Hi.
Yes, hi. Fascinating discussion to the author. What quite insight. I'm just thrilled with a conversation. I just wanted to add my 2 cents worth before I get out of cell phone range. A criminology professor I had years ago used to say that a picture may be worth 1,000 words, but 1,000 words doesn't always tell the complete story. And I would add, nor always the truth. And I think that what you're saying really resonates with me in so many instances today. You were talking about, you know, the toppling of the statue and in Iraq of Saddam Hussein. I remember seeing the pullouts, probably the exact same ones you were talking about, from local camera feed, in which showed that the majority of the people in the group were actually reporters.
Yes.
And it's fascinating. I think that your example of Bush landing on the aircraft carrier with the Mission Impossible or the Mission Accomplished sign, well, that was also contextual to the moment of, you know, the invasion was accomplished. And, you know, so, again, I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We've got about a minute left.
Why don't we go back to that wonderful image, Celeste, that you mentioned, because it
okay.
ties in, I think, very nicely with the theme. You mentioned earlier a very famous photograph. It's called Tomoko Being Bathed by Her Mother. And it was a picture taken by Eugene Smith of a Japanese woman bathing her daughter who had been a victim of mercury poisoning. And the story I tell in the book gets to this core issue of what right does the subject have? What about the person in the picture? What respect should we give them? And once the picture was used for many years, not just about Japan, but about industrial pollution worldwide. But at one point after their daughter died, the parents asked that the picture be withdrawn. And they finally contacted the widow of the photographer who had collaborated on the picture. And she wrote back a very moving letter saying that you're right. I will no longer have this photograph exhibited, and I will write to art museums and other places asking them to pull the picture down. And what's dramatic about that story is that there is a life in the picture, a person, and that does every time we take a photograph, whether it's in our daily life or whether we're looking at a news photograph, does it mean that that person in the photograph is simply our object, or do they have rights? Is there something that transcends just the picture, that there is always a life, a person, and a life story in the images that we see worthy of respect?
Yeah. What a great point to end on, because it hits at the responsibilities of all of us, whether we be the person viewing an image or a person making an image. And there we have to leave it. We are out of time. Kiku Adato, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Kiku Adato, she is a scholar in residence at Harvard University's Humanities Center. Her book, Picture Perfect, Life in the Age of the Photo Op, is published by the Princeton University Press.